I experienced in a semi-professional setting at that time because I was a student, but I worked in the lab and got paid for it, the inequality in science that there was, at least in that field. And it was very interesting. But that motivated me, I have to say, because I was proud to be one of, you know, the top students in my class. And I was proud because I was a woman.
Diversity of ideas is harder than it looks. Welcome to Innovation for All, conversations on the social impact of innovation with your host, Shayna Ahlquist.
Hi everyone, Shayna Ahlquist here. In today's episode, I spoke with Stella McShira, founder of Equalit. Earlier in her career, Stella founded the first fashion incubator in the entire United States. And that was around the same time she created Portland's first Fashion Week. No big deal. In 2016, Stella founded Equalit, a comprehensive database of women-owned businesses. In this episode, we talk about a wide range of topics, including how everyday citizens can use their discretionary income to support women. We also talk about whether it's okay to seek out businesses owned by certain groups when it may come at the expense of others. We also talk about her personal journey as a minority who, well, looks pretty darn white, and how that's shaped her thinking about discrimination. Stella was unusually forthcoming in this interview, especially about pretty sensitive topics, and I applaud her for that. And a final warning, there is the occasional fist pounding during this conversation, so please forgive any audio muffling. I think the content's worth it. Enjoy. So Stella McShira, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So I was thinking we could start out by talking about, on November 9th, you and I had a meeting scheduled for like a coffee or a lunch or something. And I got an email from you at like 4 a.m, canceling. I guess for context, you and I live in Los Angeles. So we definitely were in a liberal bubble where at the time, the perception of Donald Trump was that he wasn't really a traditional candidate. Some of the things he said were outrageous. There had recently been pretty compelling accusations that he had sexually harassed women. So where we were standing, it didn't seem like he had a fighting chance. And that was sort of borne out by the data, right? That the polling at the time believed that he didn't have a fighting chance. So you and I wake up on November 9th. And yeah, just walk me through what that day was like for you.
Well, I couldn't believe it. I actually shut down for a little while. As a matter of fact, the first thing we did in the morning on November 9th, other than cry a little, was we canceled our cable. And I deactivated Facebook and our social media accounts, mostly because I felt betrayed that the information that was being fed to me, that yes, he didn't have a fighting chance. There really was no possibility that Trump would be our president. Betrayed me because I really could not have been more surprised. And I think a lot of people in Los Angeles felt that way.
Yeah, so, I was going to say on that same note, for me, it actually shook my faith in data a little bit.
Absolutely. So I didn't want to be fed the information that I was being fed. We still don't have cable. And I limit my social media presence and activity to just what is important for my business. I struggle pretty often and very much on a daily basis with the fact that he's still in office, but it really does fuel me to keep going in what I'm doing and supporting more women running for office and the efforts that women-owned businesses are making just for their livelihoods and how they impact the rest of the economy through creating jobs and advancing more women, which creates more leaders for us and more representation where we need it.
Well, and the reason I wanted to start with the question of Donald Trump is we're going to talk about Equalit, obviously. I think you and me, perhaps, when we saw the political system shifting in a way that didn't align with some of our values, there was a feeling of like, well, what else can I do? And that's where I think Equalit is really interesting. So can you share a little bit about what Equalit is and what it does?
Sure. Equalit is a tool for anyone to find women-owned businesses. Prior to it launching, it wasn't easy to find a woman lawyer or even a gynecologist or a restaurant for that matter. And conscious consumers that wanted to do that just had to spend a lot of time looking for her. So I wanted to make it easy. And that was just a personal passion of mine. And then I realized how much influence women-owned businesses had in the lives of people in our community, and how she could and they could really help us elevate women through economically. And then I did a little further research and realized consumers spend $11 trillion every year. And certainly that could help women offset the lack of financing that they get, lack of capital that is given to women each year. And so anyway, I made it my personal mission and professional mission to support growth and success of women.
So that's interesting though. So that's saying that, you know, there's a lot of money in the economy. There's a lot of money being spent. Women separately are also not getting as much funding as men are when they're, for instance, startup entrepreneurs. So this might be a way that you can help fill in that gap.
Absolutely. We have to be resourceful. If we're getting less than 4% of investor capital, whether that's VC or angel, we're getting less than 4% of business loans. And even peer-to-peer lending, we're still not faring as well. So how can women-owned businesses be competitive when they're receiving $100,000 less than their competitor who's using that money to market or scale his business or hire new people? We have to figure out new ways, because as women, we've always had to do that in many situations and scenarios in our lives as we've grown up.
Well, and I think it's really cool, this idea too, that you're essentially providing additional information. So let's say that I believe in women's rights and I want to do more to support them economically. I can now make an informed choice about how I'm going to go get an arbitrary coffee.
Yes, absolutely. So people aren't going to change generally what they buy just because they're supporting a cause. If it's going to be sustainable, it has to meet some criteria. It has to be convenient, like a local coffee store, if you're always getting coffee. The quality has to be there. You're not going to switch long-term just because you support equality, but you're getting a shitty coffee.
Getting pink, shitty coffee.
Yeah, no, who cares? And then it's quality and convenience for certain. So we make that easy for you to determine.
And so my understanding from our prior conversations is that there's evidence that women-owned businesses do more, better for the community. Is that right? Or
so women in general, 80% of their salaries are put back into their families and by extension their communities, and where men put about 30% back in comparison. So women in general do much more for their communities. But then you have women-owned businesses. And research that I've come across shows that women-owned businesses tend to hire more diverse teams, so they're less biased in who they're hiring. They tend to pay higher wages, so more fair, equal pay. And there isn't the issue of at male-owned businesses that there is. Women tend to advance other women, you know, become managers or maybe executives at women-owned companies. So you're seeing more executives and managerial level positions with women in them at women-owned companies. And the last thing I would say is definitely the HR policies and the benefits for women and around maternity leave and paternity leave. So women-owned businesses are already doing what we'd like everyone to do. So, but there's not a lot of them. They're growing really fast. But why don't we help accelerate that? We're going to accelerate the businesses and the people that are already demonstrating gender equality in the workplace by doing business with them. We're shopping at their businesses. We're hiring those consultants and agencies that are owned by women. And if we really want it, we can invest in them, the ones that are taking investment or providing loans to them. That is a way that we can really accelerate our path to gender equality.
It's interesting because on the one hand, I love, obviously, the idea of gender equality. I'm a lady, so I like the idea of equal pay for equal work, for instance. But on the other hand, it does seem a little uncomfortable to think about, like you could easily imagine that this is like a whites only platform where it's like, right. I only want to shop at Black businesses and or even use that as a criteria of exclusion. Like, this business is owned by a Black person. I don't want to shop there. Right. Yes. Suddenly that framing makes it feel very different. Why or should we feel like this is an acceptable option?
Sure. And the difference would be equality and equity. When everyone has equal opportunities, then, you know, some people are going to shine more than others. But since we don't have equality, we have this uneven playing field. So what we're doing is we're lifting up the minority group in the situation so that they both have this equal opportunity to be competitive.
Yeah. So essentially women not getting as much seed funding isn't equal.
It isn't equal.
And so any way you could ameliorate that might actually be closer to equality.
Yes. And I understand. I'm someone who, we talked about this earlier. I am 3/4 Filipino, but I have very white features. So not a lot of people realize I'm Asian, especially because I change my hair all the time and I get every ethnicity there is. But in college, I was a neuroscience major, and I was given a scholarship, a full ride from the NIH, the National Institute of Health. And the program was the Minority Access for Research Careers, called the MARC program. I was really hesitant to take that scholarship, even though it was a full ride, because I wanted to be seen only for my wins, but not my wins because I got this disadvantage. But really, if you think about it, women and minorities are so disadvantaged up until the point of that they could receive some extra help, that it's this vicious, I don't know if it's a vicious cycle, but it's certainly, there is not just in this moment are we giving them a leg up because they're asking for it. Like myself, I really did need the money. But every interaction prior to that, many minorities or women had to make amends for lacking the resources that they needed. Mm. So I ended up taking it, and I'm so glad I did. It was very helpful to me, and it helped me be better at what I was doing, but it wasn't the reason I did as well as I did.
Oh, what do you mean?
I think because I was already going to graduate near the top of my class, but it helped me relieve some pressure that I had other places, like financial pressure. I was going to get where I was going to get because I'm a determined person. But it's amazing how many opportunities open up when you have a little bit of that pressure relieved in one area. Then you can see other opportunities in different areas. And I think that's a really important thing, that when, you know, you're thinking about your basic needs and just trying to survive, you don't see everything else other people may see that have those basic needs met. And so you're disadvantaged in that way too. So leveling that playing field is important.
Yeah. No, it's definitely hard when there are already disparities and you have to correct them, right?
Yeah.
And it feels really awkward and uncomfortable. When I used to teach at university, one of my courses that I taught was on prejudice and discrimination. And one of the recommended activities was have the class play Monopoly, but half of them would be assigned to a condition where, or a subset of the players would get to multiply their score by 10 or something like that, or you got an extra $50,000 to start with. But essentially, like, you're having one subset play by a different set of rules, and, you know, you let that go for a little while, and then afterwards you switch back to a fair system, and you let them keep playing. But at that point, like, you've already accumulated so much wealth, and, you know, Monopoly is brutal, right? Like, once you've got the Monopoly, there's no coming back. You're going to go bankrupt, right? And so then the question to the students is, how long do you think you'd have to keep playing this game before it would be equal under these quote-unquote fair rules?
Mm-hmm.
And I actually even didn't do that exercise because I thought the lesson was so obvious. But when I've explained this to other people, they're like, oh my God, that's a great lesson. Like, I would never have thought of it like that, but it's exactly what you're saying. Like, now at the 11th hour, to say that we are playing Monopoly by the same rules, it's like, well, yeah, but is that fair?
Yeah. With all of the programs and the focus on, in my world anyway, helping to correct the gender equality issue, I think it was the United Nations predicted and a number of other organizations, even on the path we're on, trying to correct this wrong, we won't achieve gender equality until 2095, if that.
And you mean like financial equality?
Yes, financial equality. And as I said earlier, you know, if women are investing 80% of their salaries back into the community, imagine how much more our community would benefit economically if they just made equal pay.
Well, yeah. And I'm wondering, you know, getting back to that number earlier, if like women are putting 80% back into the community and men are only putting in 30%, what are the men doing with the rest of the money? I'm just curious.
Yeah. So from what I've read is they have time for purchasing more things like more houses, more cars, maybe putting it back into their careers, like getting furthering their education. But definitely having the opportunity to make a choice around benefiting themselves.
I see. So you're saying, I don't know, I guess originally when I heard that number, I thought the framing was, look at how much better it would be if we gave women more money because they're putting money into the local economies. But it sounds like what you're saying now is that kind of like, no, women don't have choice, and that's why they're putting 80% here.
Oh, you know what?
The first.
It's the first.
Okay.
So it's not that women, we naturally are, that's a generalization, but
yeah.
The numbers have suggested that women tend to do this because probably we're just more nurturers. And so an example of when I was growing up, my dad is a civil engineer. He had a good salary. And my mom, she had a college degree, but she was a secretary, and she worked two jobs while my dad worked one because they split all the finances equally. And so my mom had to work twice as hard and twice as much. But then she also raised us. Like, my dad was pretty hands off, and any extra things we needed, she paid for. Our extra clothes that we really wanted as we were getting older, when we were interested, extra toys. And as we were growing up, it didn't seem unusual, but it represented that 80% to me. I mean, it was very clear that my dad did not put in the equal amount and actually kind of forced her to have two jobs, plus the full-time job as a mom. I love my dad. He's passed away, but he was not equal in that sense. It's not unusual in terms of the like family dynamics of who's working and taking care of the kids.
Yeah.
Henry Ford once said, "If I had asked people what they wanted, they would have said faster horses." Sounds like Ford hired a bad user researcher. PhD Insights is different. They help understand the attitudes and motivations that underlie what customers claim. And this is good for business. So if your company isn't adding attitudinal feedback to their data pipeline, they're missing half the story. Learn how PhD Insights can help your company with pricing, product strategy, and positioning by visiting phdinsights.com. That's phd-insights.com.
So, you know, Stella, earlier you touched on the fact that you're three quarters Filipino, but you look white. So first of all, I like to throw out that I'm always bad at guessing race. So I constantly am getting people's race wrong in a way that isn't just like, I don't see race, but it's kind of a like a human error in judgment. But can you talk a little bit about, so they call that passing, right? Like passing for white, how you feel like that might have shaped who you are?
Well, yes. So I grew up initially in Pittsburgh, California, which is a large minority population, a lot of African-Americans, a lot of Filipinos, a lot of Mexicans. And then we moved to more affluent white city, Walnut Creek, California, which apparently has blown up. It's way different than when I grew up there. So when I was in schools in Pittsburgh, I didn't even think about it. And I was in a private school there. And then we went to a public school in Walnut Creek, and I was one of four minorities. Yiling Wu, Chinese. Florence Chen, Chinese. Oh, by the way, they were my best friends. And there was a Native American gal named Erica, and then myself. Oh, I'm sorry. One African American boy, Joe Jackson, who became my first boyfriend, which really wasn't a boyfriend. He just asked me if I'd ghost anyone. So everyone always mistook me and Erica for each other. Not because we looked alike at all. And again, I have a lot of white features, but I was not white enough to have my own identity to my classmates.
How old were you in this?
So I was in the fourth grade.
Okay. So like old enough that you've been around the childhood block of fitting in as not an other before moving there.
Yes. I will say that, and this is jumping a little bit, but I fit in well enough in both scenarios because I grew up with, my parents were both born and raised in the Philippines, and they have a lot of friends that were from college that immigrated here to the U.S. into the same Bay Area. So every weekend there were about, and I'm not even kidding, about 100 people at one of the houses playing Mahjong or some other card game, and the kids were all playing. So I was always with a bunch of Filipinos on the weekends. So, and then during the week I was with primarily white people. Growing up, I always, I think, effortlessly moved between groups. But something that the show Crazy Rich Asians,
or movie,
the movie, illuminated last night, which I had already felt, was that you can fit in both, but you're not completely embraced in either. So you don't have this clear identity of being Filipino or this clear identity of being an American. So that's an interesting place to be when you're not completely rooted somewhere. It probably lends itself to why I travel a lot. I love it. And how I can tend to easily move in and out of cultures and different people pretty easily. And I really enjoy it.
It sounds like a little bit of it as an adaptive strategy of of like putting that on yourself to blend almost.
Yes. I always considered myself a chameleon. And again, with the hair changes all the time and quite a few people not recognize me, even though I do know them because my hair changes. It seems when I change my hair, my attitude changes too. So not consciously, but I know I've noticed that I'm a little more aggressive, a little less aggressive, depending on my hair. It's always kind of been like that.
So now you're blonde. What does that mean?
I don't know. I have been thinking about that. I'm growing it out right now, but I will say that I have definitely seen as more white in the last year since I've had my hair blonde. But I make a point of telling everyone I'm Filipino. I'm very proud of being Filipino. And unlike you, when you were saying that you maybe couldn't tell people's races, I can spot a Filipino, even if she has or he has maybe a quarter Filipino in them and they look most, I can spot them. And I've done that my whole life. It's a fun game for me. But no one, not one person in my entire life has ever guessed that I was Filipino.
Wow.
Ever.
Well, and so, you know, we talked a little bit about moving to, was it Walnut Creek?
Walnut Creek.
Yeah. So let's fast forward a little bit later. You went to Japan.
I did. So I lived in Japan for 3 years. And I will say I didn't face out and out racism in the States. And I hadn't experienced that until I went to Japan. And being Asian, I can say this, or I'm going to say this, that many Asian cultures are very racist. It's known throughout the Asian communities that the Asian cultures tend to have are pretty strong racist. My grandmother was horrible. But when I was in Japan, when people couldn't tell what I was, but they could tell that I had Asian eyes, they assumed I was half Japanese because I lived there for 3 years. When they realized I was Filipino, and Filipinos are like the bottom of the rung for Asians, I was clearly treated differently. There was a couple times where there were people that physically pushed me. In Japan, a very quiet culture, very not seemingly aggressive culture, but I was, someone tried to pull my nose ring out of my nose. This was back 30 years ago too, so it was probably offensive to them in general. But I wasn't someone who would not say that I was Filipino up until that point. But I had to make sure to not say it in certain situations. I was a teacher for 3 years, and if I were introduced as a Filipino teacher, how they would view me would be very different. And I am certain I would lose students because I wasn't, if they saw me as American, I was perfectly fine. If they saw me as Filipino, my worth would drop down to zero.
I think it's so interesting too, because I think the way that here in the States we're taught about racism in school is that, like, you have this really explicit, oppressive set of policies. But really what it looks like nowadays is much more subtle. It's mistaking you for, and again, it maybe isn't even racist, but like, it doesn't feel good to be mistaken for like the other minority kid in your class. It's like, yeah. But I'm Stella, I'm a person. And, yeah. And that doesn't mean that people are being malicious or misunderstand. Right. It's just, you know, really a kind of a cognitive error. But so then to make that shift from that sort of normalized, now sort of subtle, not big deal racism to like, oh, you're actually considered to be worth less here, must have been pretty noticeable.
It was noticeable. It's interesting because at the time I was a vegan. I was running 5 miles a day. I was very fit. I was doing that in the States, and then I Canada. I lived in Canada before I moved to Japan. I was continuing the same thing, the same behavior in Japan, and I realized I had such culture shock. I was very depressed that I gained 30 to 40 pounds. And actually, people kept asking me when I was due, and it was really unsettling. But whenever I would go back to the States, because I did often to renew my visa or visit my family, I would go back at periods of time for 2 weeks, I would not intentionally lose all that weight. And then I would go back and I would gain it. And it was actually that racism and that realization that what my brain and body were doing in response to that depression and oppression was really fascinating. So that's why I went back to San Francisco to study psychoneuroimmunology. And I have a degree because of racism, the racism I experienced.
So can you tell me a little bit more about your degree?
Well, I started out in biology because I wasn't sure, but I knew that I really wanted to understand what was happening to me emotionally was affecting my health. And so I was lucky that during that time, after the first semester, first year, that they started a neuroscience program at San Francisco State, and they brought in a few notable neuroscience teachers. And then I immediately got into the program and worked through the NIH scholarship program and got to be a part of it. And so, unfortunately, being a vegan, I did do animal testing, and I did do live brain surgeries on Sprague Dolly rats for a number of years, which gave me nightmares every night. And I ended up changing from neuroscience to business. I finished my degree, my biology degree, but once I did, I knew that animal testing wasn't what I wanted to do. Even though I did go to Stanford and worked in a lab for doing functional MRIs with actual humans, and I wasn't endangering them in any way. So that was great, but it did help me. I switched paths because of that.
I think it's always so interesting to think about like what people are good at and what they like, mm-hmm. and how that doesn't align with the system that they're put into, right? So like in this story, right, you're good at and you like neuroscience, but the expectations for the role you'd be in don't really align with those things.
Yes.
So do you think that neuroscience would have been cured if you had? No, but I mean, I don't know. I just think it's interesting that I think about the same thing with medical doctors, right? Like, I think part of what medical schools are really screening for when they make people work 40-hour shifts and like all these crazy things isn't actually patient compassion or medical expertise, right? It's you're also looking for something particular, like competitiveness or just being willing to take a beating, ability to cope with stress. Is that misaligned with what we really are looking for or should be looking for?
I love that you brought that up because I don't understand why that persists, that model persists, because it doesn't serve anybody. It affects the level of care that these doctors and these residents give. Well, it affects everything. And so it's why we can't change these things from that are obviously not productive. I wanted to say, given that we were talking about equality, that it was the going to school, being in a largely male-dominated field. I did have two other women in our lab, which was great, but it was clear when we went to conferences, et cetera, that it was mostly men. So I experienced in a semi-professional setting at that time, because I was a student, but I worked in the lab and got paid for it, the inequality in science that there was, at least in that field. And it was very interesting. But that motivated me, I have to say, because I was proud to be one of, you know, the top students in my class. And I was proud because I was a woman. Those things, I think they all laid the groundwork for where I am today. And just that observance and experience. Sometimes it's shitty when you're experiencing them, but it could lead to really some great things in the future for you. So, or for me.
So, Stella, can you tell people where to go if they want to learn more about Equalit?
Of course. They can go to equalit.com. That's E-Q-U-A-L-L-E-T. And you can remember that name because it's a combination of equality and wallet.
I love to end the show with this question because I definitely encourage people to question their own beliefs, consider new points of view. So what's something you've changed your mind about recently?
It's so important to be open to everything. And I've definitely had tunnel vision in terms of what I've been working on. And I think that what I need to explore more is just stuff outside gender equality right now. And in order for me to open my eyes to things that I could change my mind about.
That's a very honest answer. Yeah. Well, and I guess I'll give you a freebie. Are you still vegan?
I'm not vegan.
What? Did you change your mind about that? No, I'm just kidding.
Well, it's interesting. I was becoming very anemic, even though I am very conscious about my nutrition. I love studying and reading about nutrition. I knew that I needed some different kind of proteins. So I added eggs to my diet. And so the first 8 years I was a vegan. The next I was a vegetarian for 7 years. Then I became a pescatarian for a number of years. And occasionally now I eat meat, but that was in large part due to I traveled around the world for several years. And it was exhausting trying to find out what the ingredients is. Did they put meat broth in that thing? And so I expanded my food intake, but I really don't like meat. So I did change that.
Stella McShera, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
I hope you're enjoying today's episode. If you are, you can help us out by visiting Innovation for All on iTunes and leaving us a review. See you soon.